Listening to KRUU LP 100.1 FM, the voices of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Grassroots, listener-supported, solar-powered radio broadcasting live from the Cultural District here in Fairfield, Iowa. This is Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my co-host and mother, Caroline Kilborn.
And good afternoon, everyone. And don't forget, if you if you want to tell people about this program and they didn't get to hear it now, you can we can hear it again at Monday at 8 a.m.
8 a.m.
So you have two chances. In fact, you can hear it again if you'd like to. You're welcome to do that.
So what do we have in store for our guest today, Mom?
Oh, gosh. We have a really interesting author. Is Kenneth Woodward. Is that how you pronounce it? Okay. And he edited Newsweek's religion section from 1964 until his retirement in 2002. It's a long haul there. He remained a contributing editor at Newsweek until 2009. Although he has written more than 1,000 essays, articles, and reviews for a variety of magazines, newspapers, and scholarly publications. He is an author of Making Saints, How the Catholic Church Determines Who Becomes a Saint, Who Doesn't, and Why, and The Book of Miracles, The Meaning of the Miracle Stories in Christianity, Judaism, Buddhism, Hinduism, and Islam. He's a native of Cleveland, Ohio, and a graduate of Notre Dame. He lives in Chicago, Illinois. For more information,
and the author of his current, or the title of his current book is Getting Religion, Faith, Culture, and Politics from the Age of Eisenhower to the Era of Obama. Welcome to Writer's Voices, Ken.
My pleasure.
It's our pleasure to have you here. How did you become a religion journalist in the first place? Was that something you set out to do?
More people ask me that more often in New York than out in Iowa, I can tell you that. I walked in off the street.
Really? Oh, my gosh.
That's simple. I walked in off the street, and I was working in Omaha, and I thought it was time to go to New York. I went to Time, and I went to Newsweek, and they both offered me jobs, believe it or not. And I was only on a weekly there. And then the religion job was the one at Newsweek. I think I'm the only reason, the only person that's ever been hired because he was Catholic rather than despite it.
Okay.
And why was that? Why did they want somebody who was Catholic?
Oh, because it was Vatican Council II was coming to an end, and more people and more knowledgeable people over in Rome, in the bureau there, and they didn't have anybody who really knew much about this, and they saw that I was Catholic and that I went to Notre Dame, which means I probably should know something about my Catholicism. So I, be honest, they never said this, but I think that I know it was a major factor. So yes, that's how I got hired. And the title of my book has a couple of meanings, and one of them is my getting, that is saying learning to understand religion, and, and not just my own, but everybody else's. So that you mentioned my book on the miracles. That's a very serious study of how the function miracles function in different world religions. So it's been my trying to get it all the way along. And the other meaning to the title is Americans. Well, let me tell you a simple story. Periodically, women's magazines, especially back in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, would all of a sudden discover that there are a lot of people in America who are religious, and they would keep they would forget that, and they'd come back to it again. So there was that sense of they were learning how to get it, what was going on with their own readers. And then finally, there really was an explosion of religious energy in the second half of the 20th century. And I compare it, and I've talked to historians about this, compare it to the middle of the 19th century and the Second Great Awakening, which gave us Mormonism, which gave us the LDS Church, it gave us Disciples of Christ. There were the revival movements of all kinds. So people don't think of it that way, because most of the people who think about American religion at all are Christian, few are Jewish, and they think of indications of institutional decline, especially from the 50s, which is the most religious decade in the history of America. So my plot line is decline plus explosion. It's a double helix, and both things were happening at once. And since I was in the middle of it, and since my grandchildren will not know it unless I tell them the story,
right?
Children who were growing up in it didn't realize it was going on. I wrote the book.
Well, and in Getting Religion, it's part memoir and part kind of an analysis of what was going on in American religion during your lifetime.
And historical.
You're right. I found that if you want to engage the reader, especially the young reader, in ancient history, which it is to young people,
yeah,
you have to tell them stories. And so I used autobiography to illustrate in a most vivid fashion what it was like growing up, and I'd like to read something from you on that, growing up in the 40s and 50s, because I compare it to growing up today, and I think growing up today is infinitely harder. Every grandparent will tell you that. And and I use memoir because I'm in a strict sense, in the sense of not talking about how my parents beat me up. Actually, they didn't. Remember people like
that.
Billy Graham, the Dalai Lama, people that I got to know very, very well. So that people can relive my experiences with them and in a sense go back with me. So that's what I'm trying to do.
What did you study in college, Ken?
I studied the only thing worth studying for somebody like me. I studied literature. And at Notre Dame, and then after a stint at Michigan Law School, and long enough to discover I didn't like that, especially what they do to the language, up to Iowa City. Studied at the time that Paul Engel was at the Writer's Workshop.
Oh.
I was up on what they call up on the hill, doing more academic work. And
what year were you in at Iowa?
My God, before God got up in the morning, let's see. It had to be, I graduated Notre Dame in 57.
Okay.
So 58, 59 to 60, I guess it was. Yeah.
Okay, so you didn't overlap with Caroline because she was there earlier than that.
Yeah, I was there earlier.
Well, she might have been there. Well, Paul Engel was teaching poetry then. I think Vance Bourgeli was there. I have great stories. I'm not going to take up the time here to tell them, but fond memories of the place and funny stories. Little young ladies would come off the farms and graduate from college and go over to Wright, and they would suddenly discover, say, Eugene O'Neill, and they would all of a sudden they're dressed in black and the coloration of what they were learning. So it was a lot of fun. But my wife grew up in Estherville.
Oh.
And spent most of her life in Des Moines. So instead of going to Northwestern to study with Richard Ellman under on James Joyce, I went to Iowa because that's where my intended was.
Oh,
well.
Well, you picked a good place.
I enjoyed it a lot. I really did. And but anyhow, there is something. I mean, you'll hear it in the way I'm writing here. I want to read something to you, which is will give you an example of how I used my own growing up to talk about an era now long gone, and you'll catch the comparison very early on with what I'm getting at here. So this is called Growing Up on the Home Front, comes from the first chapter. I was born in 1935 and passed through childhood while the nation was at war. Unlike the war in Vietnam 2 decades later, World War II united the nation in common cause. Unlike our more recent wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, this war was not fought off stage by volunteers so that the good life at home could continue uninterrupted. To the contrary, on the home front, all children were suckled in a culture of sacrifice and restraint, one that linked us closer to the children of the Great Depression, though our circumstances were never so drastic, than to our own children born into post-war affluence. Beginning in 1942, staples of the good life, first sugar, then gasoline, fuel oil, and rubber tires, then fruit juices, canned and frozen food, including baby food, even shoes and clothes, were strictly rationed. As participants in the common war effort, everyone made do. My mother dutifully planted a low-yield victory garden, thin carrots, limp bean stalks, lettuce the size of baseballs. By war's end, 40% of the nation's vegetables were harvested from an estimated 20 million family plots like ours. At the store, Mother bought meat and butter with red ration stamps from her government-issued war ration book, and soups and dried beans from stamps colored blue. Because he was a salesman and his car was his living, my father got extra ration stamps for gas. At home, he did his civil duty as a suburban air raid warden. One night a month, when the warning siren sounded, he put on a yellow metal helmet on his head and went about making sure the neighbors had turned out all their lights, lest enemy bombers should penetrate the airspace over Lake Erie's southern shore. My older brother and I followed the battles overseas by pasting newspaper headlines in scrapbooks. From inside cereal boxes, we collected colorful arm patches worn by the men in uniform, and from strips of balsam wood and glue, built models of the airplanes the American pilots flew. It was a good time to be a child. So, there's a lot going on in there, as you can see. One is the comparison with today, where the kids don't even know where Afghanistan and Iraq are, where there's no draft and there's therefore no vulnerability and no interest. And
no rationing and no sacrifice.
No sacrifice whatsoever. Nope. So, I thought about that. Now, of course, I wouldn't compare it to what the kids in the Depression went through, but that's a different. That's one of the big differences that from that era, you know, to our own. And so we're hiding from things, even though every time you turn around, there's the internet and there's television and the rest of it to let you know what's going on. We're bystanders. Observers at best. And young people in colleges today, they can't even tell you where those places are either, by and large. I had a laugh when there was a lot of talk about winning the youth vote. And the thing is, young people don't vote, and they haven't for a long time, only in small percentages. So, we have, it's an argument I make at the end of the book. We have a disengaged a group of young people. It's not their fault. It's what they were born into. So that they postpone adulthood to age 30, and they're kind of on the shelf. I'm here in Chicago, and all the bars are around here, and it's they're not plunged into adulthood until much later, and that has consequences.
Yeah, I hadn't really thought about that.
I hadn't either, but you're right.
Well, I wrote a book. The first book I wrote was the grandparent-grandchild relationship, so I've tried to pay a lot of attention to connections like that. So we're a long way from religion, aren't we?
Yeah, we are. We are.
Let me tell you why. If you look at the reader looks at the chapter headings, the word Protestant, Catholic, Jew do not appear at all. What appear are phrases like embedded religion, movement religion, entrepreneurial religion. These are categories that I invented, and I hope they work, I think, to connect what's going on socially, culturally, and politically with what is going on in religion.
So what would you say is like the biggest change in America in terms of religion from your childhood to today?
Well, there are several, but there's...
I mean, I know that's what the whole book is kind of addressing.
it is, but also it isn't... It's more descriptive than anything, and to know what went on, really. One of the changes is that when the era that I am talking about, now what I wrote to you was about the late 40s, okay? The book really is second half of the 20th century, because I actually came of age during the 50s. One of the differences was that the culture, the post-war culture in which we were fighting an atheist enemy, right? Mm-hmm. Atheist communism. It was never just communism, but atheist communism. The culture as a whole supported religious belief, behavior, and belonging. As I said before, it was the most religious decade in American history, and therefore it's an anomaly. People usually aren't that religious. As I say in the book, we built more churches and synagogues and houses of worship in the 50s than we have before, ever did before or since. And people went to them. They filled them. If you were polled, they said 98% say they believed in God. By 1960, half the Catholic school-aged children were in Catholic schools. And the Protestant seminaries were turning men away, and the kind of folks that were accepted were the ones that typically, you know, would have become doctors or lawyers or, let's say, corporate captains of industry. Not so today. So that couldn't be sustained, but it is the environment that I grew up in. And one of the things I talk about is what religion you were. That religion was really what made the culture diverse. And so those are the kinds of, I don't want to get into all these details, but that's very different from today. We think of diversity today as start out being either male or female, which is not very diverse. If you only got two kinds, we've sliced the onion thinner since then.
Yeah.
Religion, like in Iowa, or let's say Wisconsin, whether you're either Lutheran or Catholic, and of course down south there were more Baptists than there were people, environments, a lot. And that's what I talk about in that.
And what religion your parents were was almost always going to be what religion you were.
Well, that's still pretty much true today. Now, that's what I call embedded religion, okay? So in there I talk about, in that book I talk about growing up Catholic, and I say to be Catholic a Catholic in those days was to imagine yourself at the center of concentric circles of belonging. It was all the Catholics in your parish. It was all the Catholics in the other parishes that you met when you went to Mass elsewhere, usually in traveling. It was all the Catholics that ever were or ever likely to be. And then there were those saints looking down on us like grandparents from high front porches. That's the view of a child, that sense of belonging. Mm. And I think, I know from people who have told me because they've read the book, you can analogize, you don't have to be Catholic to be that way, who felt comfortable in the environment they were in, and in neighborhoods, and in local institutions, very much the church, but others. And that's what I'm talking about. And most of that is gone, too. Neighborhoods, can't speak for Fairfield, Iowa, but neighborhoods don't exist like they do because there's nobody home. Hmm. Nobody home to call out from the front porch or front door and say, Jamie, your mother wouldn't like you doing this, or Charlie, I got hot donuts, come on in. Both people are working. We're in a different, we're in a work society now, so it's very different.
Yeah. Well, I grew up, came of age in the 60s and 70s, and a lot of people my age questioned the, you know, the institutional authorities and questioned the religions from a very young age. I mean, I talked to
friends
about that a lot.
That's true, and I certainly deal with that. What happened in your generation, which you identify with, is that your numbers were so great, you simply overwhelmed every institution you came into. I can't stress that enough as a necessary condition for understanding the 60s and questioning institutions, okay? And on what basis did they question them, since they didn't know much coming in, right?
Right.
It's a little hard to understand that, but it was their numbers. And, of course, there was the war. Mm. Who wants to go to a war in Vietnam? That's why the anti-war stuff pretty well stopped when the draft was rescinded.
Right.
Guessing there wasn't real and genuine opposition. But there was opposition to almost anything, you know. Anything institutional was bad because the individual was good. Well, that's the kind of thing that kids think.
Yeah, and we're kind of hearing that again today.
Oh, you are, to some extent.
Yeah.
And I my perspective is a little different. The demand to make growing up today is like what Norman Mailer called creating advertisements for myself. Think of what kids have to do, and they are told at an early age they got to get good grades, and if they want to, because they got to go to college, and in some cases got to go to a really good. If you're going to make something of yourself, well, from a strictly religious point of view, we don't make something of ourselves. That's something of a typical American myth. And it really does suggest that everything resides in ourselves. And so you can't very well be religious if you're preoccupied with yourself. Now, there are some styles of Christianity that cater to that. I mean, you've seen Joel Osteen on television and so forth. There's a lot of that ridiculous stuff, but
the whole prosperity gospel thing.
Yeah, that's all about themselves. And so that does cater to that.
Yeah,
to that effort. One of the problems I worry about is the alienation of institutions. What are the institutions? Let's put it this way: there's been a lot of talk lately about young people, the millennials, not being as religious as previous generations, and I talk a lot about this in the book and why, but and you put your finger on it in that they're alienated from all institutional anything.
Mm-hmm.
They're brought up by a new following a new social script. I am able to recreate as I do in the book, the whole thick sense of growing up and the social arrangements and the institutions. Family's an institution. Schools are institutions. You know, they, you know, like the character from a good book, you know, they abide in me still as I abide in them. And that's a great sense of belonging and having, not just a naked self, but an embedded self. So religion in back in those days, I call embedded religion. And geography played a role, ethnicity played a role, always does in religion. So where you lived, what your ethnicity was also determined in some ways what kind of religion you got. So you got it from the locals. The other kinds of religion, the one that comes into play in the, well, it begins in the 50s, is movement religion. And that's a fairly, rather rich chapter. I mean,
oh, yeah, let's talk a little bit more about that. But first, I want to make sure that our listeners know who we're talking to.
Yes, idea.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Kenneth Woodward, former religion editor of Newsweek for almost 40 years, and author of Getting Religion, Faith, Culture, and Politics from the Age of Eisenhower to the Era of Obama. So how do you define movement religion?
Well, I mean, it's so much more than noticing it than what an embedded religion, where you come from matters, what your, you know, family was and religious background was, where you lived, all that sort of thing. Movement religion is just the opposite. And it really begins with Martin Luther King, and which is in, you know, the middle of the 50s, by the way. It's not a 60s phenomenon. And he's dead in the middle of the 60s. Anyhow, that's...
And did you know him?
Where you come from what your ethnicity doesn't matter. You could be a Unitarian from Massachusetts. You could be a Lutheran from Wisconsin, Methodist from Clinton, Iowa. It didn't matter. What mattered is the brother and sisterhood of the movement. You didn't have to be religious at all, as a matter of fact. A lot of people in the movement weren't. What matters is the movement. And the movement is a sense of we're moving with history. History's on our side. That's what you identify with, and that's where your attachment is. So in the book, I look at various movements. I spent time in Latin America, where Americans, North Americans were very much involved. Liberation theology is a variation. The women's movement and religion is something rather different because the founders weren't religious at all and didn't think about it at all. And I knew Betty Friedan, and I knew Gloria Steinem, and I'm much less impressed with them than a lot of people are, you know, as thinkers and so forth. So you had those movements, but let me give you another example, which is happens in the 80s, and this chapter is called Sacred Families. Now, beginning with the Moynihan Report, Daniel Patrick Moynihan, you guys must remember that, mm-hmm. where he talked about what was happening in the black to the black family, the African American family, and 20 years later. The same statistics applied to white families, only because they were white instead of black, we engaged as a culture in what he called defining deviancy down, in another of his famous essays. So the background is the decline of marriage in the family, to the point where now marriage is essentially a lifestyle option. Marriage is also an institution, so it's an institution that's really been cracked and broken, and therefore the family, divorce rate, all of that, you know, that's those statistics. In any case, in the 80s, a million kids a year ran away from home. And as I say in the book, these were not Huck Finns hailing out, you know, down the Mississippi for adventure, nor were they poor kids, by and large. They were college freshmen, sometimes sophomores, high school seniors, usually middle class and up families, mostly white, And a lot of them victims, let's say, of what had been happening to the marriage and the family. At the same time, we saw the emergence of more than 300 new religious movements. They were called cults then in those days, mm-hmm. which is a pejorative. But so you look at the nature of these cults, if you will, and I described several of them, but spent a lot of time on the Unification Church of Dr. Moon, which is huge at the time. They usually had, they took the form of sacred families with a mother and father. Dr. Moon was the father, and his wife was the mother, and I could go through a lot of them. There were Bowen Peep, one of those cults that ended up committing mass suicide, but 300 of them. So the connection between the rise of the cults, which people don't know about anymore because they did disappear, is connected, in this case, to changes in society and structures and the collapse of an institution. So that's how I treat religion. It's always involved in what is going on. It isn't something separate. So that's an example. Wow. Of what I mean by treating religion, culture, and politics together.
Now, you met a lot of the kind of religious figures of this time period in your work with Newsweek, right?
I did.
And do you, you know, were there some that you, you know, felt their kind of godliness, or did they all just seem pretty human to you?
Well, they didn't seem particularly godly. I mean, there were some people who understood that they were living in the presence of God and others who didn't. Let me, I've been talking a lot here. Let me tell you, got something in here about Billy Graham, whom I knew very well. And I did a cover story on Billy during the Nixon period and went out, and there's a long section on him, which
you know, I remember him as a child. I remember, you know, I grew up Catholic also, so we weren't necessarily fans of Billy Graham, but I always was annoyed when his big meetings preempted my favorite TV shows.
Yeah, well, so anyhow, what's happening here is this was at the height of his connection with Billy Graham. With Nixon and with his also the anti-war protests and so forth. Let's see if I can find this here. I'm going to do a cover story on Billy, and I treat him a little differently. I treat him as a preacher of the American civil religion as it existed at that time. We don't need to go into that concept here, though. I just lost a page. And so I'm out there, and I meet Billy, and I notice that he's all the guys on his team. You know, the organist, the singer, they're all wearing green. They're like Southern football coaches. They have everybody on the coaching team has the same colors on. Well, they had the same. Even the car matched their coats. And I'd gone out on a Sunday in the red eye, and thinking, well, when I get to Mass today, and seemed a little hard the way the day was laid out for me and so forth. I also learned talking to Billy, he didn't much go to church either. In fact, he never went to church, or very rarely, when he was out doing crusades, which was more than half of his time. So anyhow, that's a little background. So we get to his old radio studio. He's editing, looking at a tape of a crusade he gave at which Nixon appeared in Knoxville, Tennessee. And it was a very important crusade because Nixon was there. And he was really, Nixon at that time it's not welcome on college campuses, and Billy made it possible for him to be on a college campus, holding a crusade and on one, and then inviting. Anyhow.
Okay.
Here's what I write. Whatever else they may be, evangelists are genuine American performance artists. And in watching Graham on videotape, I was witnessing one of the best. We're in his studio now. I also watched Billy watching himself. What are you experiencing, I asked. I expected an analysis of his technique, perhaps some second guessing of his doppelganger on the monitor, but that is not what I got. Quote, I get so engrossed, Ken, I don't think of the man on television as me. I think of him as another person speaking because the Spirit of God begins to speak to me through him. At that moment, I began to understand what makes evangelical preaching more than just a hortatory exercise. Through his voice, Graham was exercising a priestly function. It wasn't just the Bible preached as the Word of God that mattered. It was the orchestrated collective experience, the speaking and the hearing and the singing that made Christ present to the crowd. I was witnessing a verbal sacrament, though Graham would never use such terms, in which Christ, the Word made flesh, became Christ, the flesh made words. Just by listening to himself on videotape that Sunday in Los Angeles, Billy Graham had made it to church after all. So, there's a lot of theological stuff in those sentences for those who know their theology. And I was trying to recapture for the reader, and especially the non-Baptist, non-evangelical reader, exactly what that preaching meant. You've heard, I've heard Baptists say, if they haven't heard a good sermon, then they haven't been to church. People in the sacramental churches, Catholics, or especially Orthodox Christians, the more high church Episcopalians, the Lutherans, it's a different experience. They have a different sense of presence. So there really is diversity in Christianity. And
you know, one thing I found interesting,
to explain what it means,
when you're writing about Billy Graham, you said, you quote him as saying that he felt most at home in the evangelical wing of the Anglican Church.
Yeah, he did. I'm glad you brought that up, but that's true. There's a lot of things about Billy in there that people who think they know Graham don't really. But he did. Among other things, he's in his plain Baptist threads, you know, and he liked sort of the contrast with all the people in their robes. But the Baptist ritual, and it is a ritual, they wouldn't like to call it, but it is, speaks to the ear and the mouth, okay? It is singing and preaching and hearing the singing and hearing the preaching.
And, of course, the culmination of the ritual is the altar call.
Yeah, with no altar.
And I was actually talking about this with friends recently because I was at a kind of an activist meeting, and I recognized some elements of the altar call in that. And, you know, as I said, I grew up Catholic, but I had in a mostly Protestant community. And so I had a lot of Protestant friends, and I went to some revival meetings with them as a child. And I was always uncomfortable with the kind of the emotional aspect of it, how I felt like there was this deliberate attempt to play on my emotions. And even as a child, that bothered me.
Sure.
And
sure.
Yet I still succumb to it.
There are different sensibilities. And I think if we don't understand what those sensibilities are and how they're different, we don't understand each other all that well. Billy never quite understood the sacramental tradition of Catholics. He just never got it. And And it takes some time to work yourselves into this. Look, I wrote a book on world religions. I spent a year trying to figure out Hinduism. It's very difficult because it's so unlike anything we have over here. Anyhow, but just on these levels of sensibility, I'll give you an example. Personal, it's not in the book. Religion editor at Time Magazine for several decades was evangelical by background, Calvinist, Northern Michigan, and he would talk about church. What he meant by church was the local congregation. And when I talked about church, sitting in the back of my mind always was this huge complex stretching around the world and finding an apex in Rome. And it's not that we didn't have congregations or Catholics, they do. There's a lot of discussion in there. After Vatican Council II, I was over in Rome, and there was a lovely Methodist historian, theologian, wonderful man, who was trying to help this young reporter along, and he says, he's from Texas. Ken, you got to understand something, Ken. Down in their hearts, we Protestants distrust the structures we've created, meaning denominations. Because denominations were created in the United States. They weren't created in Europe. Mm. And he said, deep down, you have to understand, even for the most liberal Catholic, Holy Mother of the Church is, God damn it, Holy Mother of the Church. And in his rough way, was talking about two different sensibilities there. Mm. So a lot of that kind of stuff plays in and around the paragraphs and of my book.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Kenneth Woodward, author of Getting Religion, Faith, Culture, and Politics from the Age of Eisenhower to the Era of Obama. Before we run out of time, Ken, I want to ask you a little bit about your friendship with the Dalai Lama and how that came about.
Dalai Lama and I are the same age, and I used to needle him. I said, you and I are the same age, minus a few million reincarnations. He would laugh that wonderful laugh, and he very engaging guy. He's non-threatening. You know, everybody wants to be a Buddhist that isn't anything else, and they don't really understand Buddhism. But I talk about that, and he talked about it. He didn't like what I call the designer Buddhism you get in America. Right? Mm. One of the things you learn from the book is that most Buddhists throughout history and even today don't meditate. And even most monks don't meditate, and yet what Americans want out of Buddhism is meditation, calm the nerves, all that kind of stuff. A lot of them are converts, are Jewish or Christian. They're trying to get away from heavens and hell. Well, Tibetan Buddhism's got six heavens and six hells. How much of the other religion do you want to take? Okay. Every religion that ends up on the American shores gets transformed, I think, by the American experience. It simply goes with the territory. But there's one person in the book that does not get criticized.
And that is?
Well, his name is Abraham Joshua Heschel. And you should read his books, a little book on the Sabbath. And so forth. I'm going to read a little bit, very short about it. I met him during he was a leader of the clergy and laymen concerned about Vietnam, and he marched with King. He's a little short guy with the yarmulke and the white beard you see in all the pictures at Selma. And I wrote about Selma, but that's another story. Anyhow, so I do a story on him, and he invites me to come back and talk to him. So I go up to Jewish Theological Seminary in the Upper West Side of New York, and here's what I find. Within the warren of faculty offices at Jewish Theological Seminary, Heschel's was the smallest, windowless like the restroom down the hall, and not nearly so roomy. Tilting mounds of books rose up like stalagmites from his desk and teetered precariously from the bowed shelves above his head, threatening at any moment to bury him under the text he loved so much. Although he never mentioned it to me, his cramped quarters were indicative of the rude treatment he experienced at the seminary. Here he is, the greatest rabbi of the 20th century, and this is what's happening to him. He was, now back here, he was not permitted to sit in the front row of the synagogues for service, only rarely asked to give a blessing over the Torah reading, and in his 27 years at the seminary, he was never asked to deliver a sermon, an honor even students were accorded. Why? Because his Hasidic theology and piety contradicted the post-Enlightenment Judaism of the seminary. Our conversations always began with a topic of my choosing, and his reply invariably was in the same Hasidic fashion. My friend, let me tell you a story. Well, I tell stories about Heschel. Now, here's the end of his life. According to Jewish... Let me see if we got time. Yeah, I think we do.
Oh, yeah.
According to Jewish tradition, it is a blessing to die on the day God set aside for rest. For Heschel, the Sabbath was, quote, a foretaste of eternity, end of quote. And so it happened that my rabbi died sometime between Friday evening and the Saturday morning after a Shabbat meal with his family and friends. Okay. But it was not until I began to write this book that I came across a final Heschel story. According to Edward Kaplan's fine biography, when Sylvia Heschel, his wife, discovered that Sabbath morning that her husband had died, she placed two books indicative of his life beside the table. The Best and the Brightest, David Halberstam's incisive critique of Nixon's war cabinet, and the Keter Shem Tov, a Hasidic classic. She then removed the less edifying material he actually had been reading. My cover story on his friend, Episcopal Bishop Paul Moore, Jr., Christmas issue of Newsweek, was, I like to think, our final conversation.
Oh, wow.
So, there were all kinds of people that were worth knowing. By the way, Billy Graham changed a lot in this age. He changed, he wasn't so smug, he really confessed this stuff to me in an article, and I talk about it in the book. But he was over in, when he went to Eastern Europe, he discovered that the Christians there who were suffering under communism were better Christians than he knew down south. Mm. And it took him a long time to realize that. And while he was over there in Poland, he was supposed to meet with the Archbishop of Krakow, but the Archbishop got called away to Rome. Because they were going to elect a new pope, and of course he never came back because they elected him. So Billy is sitting there. Billy is watching the TV, and out comes Wojtyła, right? Paul VI, John Paul II, and he gets up and says, "You know, Christ is the answer." And Billy says to himself, "Oh my God, this guy's an evangelist like me." He was right. All the hats that Pope wore, all his philosophy and all the rest of it, his geopolitical involvement, he was an evangelist. Billy understood that.
Wow.
And they got to be good pals. And when John Paul II died, the only organization other than churches that were invited to was the Billy Graham Association to his funeral.
Wow.
So Billy really went through a change. And I think all for the better. I can't speak for his son, don't want to talk about him, but he was a very different man.
Well, Caroline just mentioned that she interviewed Billy's daughter on the radio some years ago.
I was on the Christian radio station in Burlington.
Oh, yeah. She's a good preacher. I know her, yeah.
Yeah.
I was at a conference on Billy, and we had a chance to talk. And her husband was Billy's, supposed to be the guy that would wear his mantle, but,
right.
Oh, I can't think of his name. I can see his face. Well, we're telling a story there. When I was talking to Billy one time, I asked a very Catholic sort of question. I said, "Billy, what's it like to know that you're saved?" Because Catholics, if they really know their religion, know that they're not assured of that. It's a hope, all right? And although a lot of them act like they're saved, right?
Right.
He said, "Oh, Ken, it's so wonderful. It's hard to describe." I said, "Well, Billy, what happens if you, you know, crawl in the hay with the organist?" I had to use this euphemism, you know. hushed anyhow. And he said, well, I just wouldn't get as high a place in heaven. That sounds like a good deal, being an insurance policy and all. So I was talking to Senator Mark Hatfield, who's a very, very serious member of the Primitive Baptist Church, and a wonderful man. And I told him this story. And he said, looked at me, no smile. He said, Ken, he said, if I didn't know I was saved, I couldn't get up in the morning. And I said, Mark, if I knew I was saved, I wouldn't get up in the morning. I know that as a kind of, again, different sensibilities.
Well, you know,
I told that story in front of Billy's daughter. Her husband said, I'm going to teach you, young man, some theology. I said, don't bother. I know what you're going to say. But anyhow, you're entering somebody else's language field and how they understand themselves in their relationship to, in this case, in the relationship to Christ. So,
you know, it's interesting because my ex-husband was raised in an evangelical background and in a community that was pretty evenly Catholic and Protestant, with quite a bit of the Protestants being towards the evangelical. And they resented the Catholic kids because they got to do whatever they wanted to on Saturday night and then go to confession and be forgiven.
Oh, they had really a weird understanding of confession. You can do what you want.
Yeah.
Let's remember an evangelical named Bill Clinton, okay?
Yeah, right.
It was the same sort of thing. You take counsel and all that sort of thing. Yeah, I mean, and kids' caricatures of other kids' religions or something.
Absolutely. And other people would say, well, you know, when you get to, you can be saved, and no matter how bad you are, you go get saved and everything gets wiped away. And I remember thinking as a youngster that they only really wanted people who had been bad. That, you know, that those were the ones that got all the glory for being saved.
Well, you know what the truth is? I think an awful lot of these stories that you hear from evangelists, some of them, about their past days and how they got saved, they make themselves out to be a lot worse than they really were.
Yeah, I think so.
Like my
too.
Mother used to do, is the story got better the more she told it. And, I think that's what happened. So there's nothing like a sinner who's been
exactly. All the speakers that they'd bring in were always people who'd been like in the.
You're in Iowa. My father was my brother was from a Protestant family, and he got saved by the very colorful Billy Sunday when he was 16 years old, and it stuck with him the rest of his life. He married my mother. I talk about this in the book, and. And Irish-Italian family, and promised to raise the kids Catholic, and he did, and he suddenly came to realize that there wasn't all that much difference in terms of what was expected of you morally and all the rest. We've lost a lot of that, and there was a shared sense of sin. You don't hear anybody talking about that much anymore, even among an awful lot of the evangelical preachers. And it's seeing, you know, your own moral life in terms of actually committing sins. I think of this Pope Francis. First thing he said about himself in an interview with a bunch of Jesuit editors was, I'm a sinner, and I need the mercy of God. Well, everybody heard the mercy, but nobody heard the sinner. Part. And so, while I don't talk about that, this Pope in that book, this is a history book after all, he certainly does get, people do block out what they don't want to hear from him. That said, he's all over the place. It's a little hard sometimes to connect the dots.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I was just interviewing someone, I'm trying to remember who it was, who had said when they were talking about sin, and their editor wanted them to change that and not refer to it as sin because it was like too much of a downer.
Oh yeah, we're really well. That's, we Weinstein, he doesn't talk about it either. And I could name a bunch more of people who have these big, awful churches of 10,000 people, and it looks like entertainment on a stage. It's...
Listen, Ken, before we only have a couple minutes, and I want to go back to something you said earlier about the 50s being the most religious decade. I think many of us grew up with this idea that the founding fathers, the beginning of America, that everybody was so religious back then. I'm just saying
that's the estimate we have.
But it's not true, is it?
7% of Americans in those days. I mean, we're not talking about the Puritans that came over. We're talking about when we had something of a country going. So, no, they weren't. Benjamin Franklin was more like it, and he wasn't particularly religious. He was a deist. So, no, country had a religious root, but it also has Enlightenment roots. And Jefferson writes a Bible, creates a Bible where he clips out all the miracles, things like that, cursed by stuff like that.
I know, and it's funny how we seem to have lost that perspective on history to such a large extent.
Well, because that was a product of the Christian right and the fundamentalists coming. There's some pretty rich chapters in there I'll just leave you with this, that people didn't know, that the moral majority of Jerry Falwell was not created by Falwell. It was created by two Catholics and a Jew, and they were operatives, conservative operatives within the Republican Party. And so they created it, called it the moral majority, and basically recruited Falwell to run it. And it was mainly they saw that Jimmy Carter had gotten all these evangelical votes from fundamentalists who never voted before. At all, and so he didn't want to see this new constituency to go to the Democratic Party. Mm. And so they worked hard to recruit him for the Republicans, and they were largely successful, although I have to say, in this election, a lot of the media, especially in the East, have way overestimated the evangelical involvement. You and Iowa have got... The Republican Party there has got a fairly strong constituency of those in Iowa, but they're pulling the Republican lever because they consider themselves Republican, and then they've been doing it for a long time.
Right. So. Well, I'm glad to hear that you think that. We only have less than a minute left, and I just wanted to ask you. You know, whenever we're talking about religion, it can be controversial. You don't seem to hold anything back in this book. Some of it's probably quite controversial. Are you getting any flack?
No, I've been this way for 50 years. So, you know, when you're a religion editor and you go to a cocktail party, they say, you do what? Okay. Also, I go back to Italy a lot. And if you want a successful dinner party in Italy, you talk about religion, and you talk about sex.
And politics.
Art. Hey, those are the three things you must talk about, or you haven't had a successful party. So my Italian heritage comes forward when this...
Well, Kenneth, thanks so much for being with us today. It's really been our pleasure. To have you on Writer's Voices.
And where can we find your book?
This book is available anywhere books are sold. Getting Religion, Faith, Culture, and Politics from the Age of Eisenhower to the Era of Obama. And, Mom, do you have some final words of wisdom for us?
I do. Actually, this is a quote from the Dalai Lama. When you talk, you are only repeating what you already know. But if you listen, you may actually learn something new.
Stay tuned if you're listening on Friday to Planet Erstwhile with James Moore. And tell your friends if they missed this. They can catch us Friday morning at 8 a.m. Monday morning at 8 a.m. And see you next week on Writer's Voices. Thank you. Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline is a production of KRUU-LP 100.1 FM, produced by Monica Hadley and James Moore. Archives available on KRUUFM.com and writersvoices.com.